Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Crime and Crime Again discusses true crime stories that may contain disturbing content. Listener discretion is advised. In this episode, I'll be discussing things such as racism, acts of genocide against Indigenous people, mental health, suicide, pregnancy loss, and other topics that may be distressing for some listeners. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. So today's episode will cover several different topics that are very important in the lives of Indigenous people. This episode provided several different opportunities for these topics to come up, and I felt that it was important that I use these opportunities and have these discussions. So without further ado, let's get right into today's story, which is the life and death of Misty Upham. Misty Ann Upham was born on July 6, 1982, in Kalispell, Montana. She was of the Blackfeet Nation, and she grew up in both Montana and Washington. She and her family lived both on and off of the reservation. Misty's mother was a stay-at-home mom and homemaker, while her father, Charles Upham, was a music teacher. Here we get into a little bit of her parents' background, as both of her parents had been sent to boarding schools as children, known formally as Indian Industrial Schools. I felt that the fact that Misty's parents had both been sent to these quote-unquote schools as children provided an opportunity to take a deeper look into a dark and devastating chapter of American history. It's a chapter that has effectively been omitted from the history books, and that is not widely taught in our high schools, if at all. I know that I personally never learned about any of this in high school, and the same is true for everyone that I've spoken to about it. For centuries, a tremendous effort has gone into hiding the true extent of the genocide committed against Indigenous people in this country. Indian Industrial Schools began in 1860 on the Yakima Indian Reservation in Washington with the establishment of the first of these schools by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Two men named Herbert Welsh and Henry Pancoast, reformers who helped to establish organizations such as the Board of Indian Commissioners and the Women's National Indian Association, made it their goal to assimilate natives into the settler way of life. Their plan was to do so by founding these schools and using education to quote-unquote civilize natives and enforce settler beliefs and lifestyles on them. By the 1880s, there were 60 of these schools operating on reservations in the United States, and over 6,200 Native children had been sent to these schools. Some were day schools, and others were boarding schools. However, white settlers wanted to implement stronger assimilation tactics and further remove Native children from their families and their cultural identity. They wanted complete and utter eradication of Native culture. This is where a man named Richard Henry Pratt enters the story. Pratt was an American general, and he decided that he wanted to conduct an experiment to determine how effectively he could assimilate natives into the white settler way of life. He started by teaching native prisoners of war how to speak English and how to read and write. He also forced them to wear military uniforms. When his methods had the desired result, he took the tale of his assimilation experiment to the federal government. In 1879, the federal government funded the very first off-reservation boarding school for Native American children. This school was known as Carlisle Indian Industrial School. The entire motto of this school was quote-unquote, "Kill the Indian, save the man," coined by Richard Henry Pratt. Carlisle Indian Industrial School was located in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Native children were taken from their families and sent to this quote-unquote school. Families who refused to send their children to these schools were subjected to consequences such as deprivation of food rations and even incarceration. Within the walls of these institutions, Native children's entire cultural identities were stripped away from them. Boys' long hair and braids were cut off, and girls also had their hair cut. They were forced to wear traditional clothing, in other words, the clothing that the white settlers wore. They weren't allowed to go by the names given to them by their families. They were given new names, even surnames. On top of all of this, they were forbidden from speaking in their native tongue, and were forced to learn and speak English. The founders and teachers of these schools claimed that the primary focus was academic education and integration into settler ways of life. History was taught with a very clear bias. Columbus Day was taught as a day of discovery and celebration, and the same teachings of Thanksgiving we experience as kids in school today were also taught to Native children at these boarding schools. Thanksgiving was taught as a holiday that celebrated quote-unquote good, aka compliant, Indians who helped the pilgrims. Truthfully, it was industrial training and forced manual labor, not academics, that was the primary education. These schools were required to be mostly self-sufficient, and as a result, it was the Native children who were forced to attend these schools that performed most of the responsibilities. Girls learned domestic duties, such as cooking, cleaning, sewing, etc., while boys performed more demanding physical labor, such as blacksmithing, shoemaking, etc. Carlisle implemented a placing-out system. This is where they place Native children in settler communities, often for just a summer or an entire year at a time. Their goal with this system was to further integrate Natives into settler society. At the Phoenix Indian School, girls took on most domestic duties for white families, and boys were placed in manual labor jobs that white people didn't want. Conversion to Christianity was another assimilation tactic implemented by these schools. Heavy emphasis was placed on the Ten Commandments, and boys and girls were often housed separately. In some cases, girls were locked in their dorms at night, which posed a serious fire hazard. On top of all of the other horrors within the walls of these schools, tuberculosis and trachoma were two illnesses that were prevalent at these institutions. Tuberculosis is an infection that affects the lungs. Symptoms of active TB can include coughing that can last for weeks, coughing up blood, chest pain, loss of appetite, weight loss, fatigue, fever, night sweats, and chills. Tuberculosis can also affect the kidneys, brain, and spine. Trachoma is a bacterial infection of the eyes. Today, it's the leading preventable cause of blindness. Symptoms can include small bumps on the inside of the eyelids, itchiness, mucus or pus in the eyes, and ultimately loss of vision. So two extremely unpleasant illnesses to be afflicted with, and it's easy to assume that the Native children at these schools did not have access to proper health care. In December of 1899, the Phoenix Indian School experienced a measles outbreak. Over a 10-day period, there were 325 cases of measles, 60 cases of pneumonia, and 9 deaths. Between 1879 and 1918, there were a total of 200 Native children who died while in attendance at Carlisle. I wasn't able to find any specified causes of these deaths. These institutions would enforce harsh and extreme forms of discipline. This could range anywhere from confinement and withholding of food to corporal punishment. There were many, many reports of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within these institutions. Richard Henry Pratt was the superintendent of Carlisle Indian Industrial School for nearly 25 years. He was known to push propaganda for Carlisle, hiring photographers to document the befores and afters of Native children's transformations during their attendance at Carlisle. These transformations were the complete stripping of their cultural identities. Unfortunately, his propaganda worked, and eventually there were over 350 of these boarding schools. In 1900, there were an estimated 20,000 Native children in these schools. By 1925, that number grew to 60,000. Just at Carlisle alone, an estimated 10,000 Natives were sent to the school between 1879 and 1918. Many Native families whose children had been stolen from them camped outside of these boarding schools in the hopes that they would be able to maintain contact with their children. Many children entirely lost communication with their families and never returned home. In 1928, a report was made public that shed light on the brutality and abuse that occurred within these schools, and thankfully, as a result, many of the boarding schools began to close. Eventually, the federal government relinquished control over the remaining schools, and the tribes themselves took over control in partnership with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. In the 1950s, adoption of Native children by primarily white families was imposed as another assimilation tactic. A media campaign was launched that encouraged white families to adopt Native children and integrate them into settler society. This campaign pushed the idea that Native children were unwanted or neglected by their families, when in fact, many of these children were very much wanted and were ripped away from their families. Social workers would generally use vague terms, such as unfit parenting, as evidence to justify the forcible removal of Native children from their reservations and their families. By the 1960s, about 1 in 4 Native children were living in adoptive homes, and many Native families were threatened if they didn't give up their children. In 1978, the Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted into federal law, and this is a law that gives tribal governments sole jurisdiction over children who reside on a reservation. The last Indian industrial school was not closed until 1973. So again, this is something that I never learned in high school. I never learned about any of that. I myself am from the Passamaquoddy Nation in Maine. I did not grow up on the reservation, as my immediate family left the reservation many years before I was born. However, much of my extended family does still live there. And after learning about these schools that I was never taught about, I realized that it's very likely that some of my own family members could have attended these schools. While researching these schools, I was very emotional. I spent a lot of time crying, learning about this. It is absolutely horrific, and it is shameful. It's hidden from today's younger generations, and there's no doubt in my mind that the effort to keep these things secret from future generations will persist. And that is why I thought that it was so important that I talk about this, and that I shed some light on this, because I know that there are probably still a lot of people who have no idea that tens of thousands of Native children were stolen from their families, had their cultural identities ripped away from them, and were completely removed from their heritage and their culture. And personally, I feel that this chapter in America's history can be strongly linked to the identity struggles and crises that many Natives feel even today, myself included. My father is white, so I am not what people would call quote-unquote full Native. So I have dealt with a lot of identity struggles as a result of this, and also contributing to that struggle is the fact that I grew up off of the reservation. I was not raised within my culture. And now, after learning about all of this, I realize that so many Natives probably have the same exact struggle. And that is exactly what settlers wanted. They wanted Natives to question their identity. They wanted Natives to forget their identities. They wanted Natives entirely eradicated. And because they couldn't quite achieve that, they did their best to eradicate their culture. So now we can get into the rest of Misty's story. After his experiences, Charles Upham wanted a better life for his children than what he felt life on the reservation could offer them. In an article written by, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce this name, but this article written by Kristen Millaris Young and published on The Guardian in June 2015, Charles says, quote, "I was determined to take my kids away from the reservation, where so many young people fail out, to a place where they could get an education, have a grounding experience. I told the kids that they were going to learn that there is a stigma associated with being an American Indian, that people were racist, and that we lived under this stigma of alcoholism and being uneducated." End quote. I wanted to give a huge shout out to Kristen Millares Young for her brilliant article and interviews with those closest to Misty. Her article is where I learned so much of the information that I'm going to share with you in this episode. The family moved to Billings, Montana, so that Charles could work toward a degree in music education. Charles recalls a friend that Misty had in Billings, who she had spent a lot of time with. When that friend's mother found out that Misty was Native, the friend told Misty that they could no longer be friends. This friend told Misty that they couldn't be friends anymore because her mother didn't want her to get bugs, implying that Misty and her family must be dirty or unclean because they were Native. Eventually, her family moved back to the Blackfeet Reservation. It was much harder to make a living there, and the family often faced financial strain. At some point, Misty had told a friend that she had experienced sexual abuse at the hands of someone close to her family, beginning at a very young age. She had also opened up about having been gang-raped at 13 years old. This is not uncommon. More than 1 in 3 Native women are sexually assaulted in their lifetime, which is a rate that's about 2.5 times higher than non-Native women. Studies conducted in 2010 by the U.S. Department of Justice showed that 56% of Native American and Alaska Native women had experienced sexual violence in their lifetime. The abuse and trauma that Misty had suffered resulted in a severe struggle with anxiety that started at a young age. She battled frequent panic attacks and had been prescribed medication for anxiety. She also began to self-medicate with alcohol, and eventually she faced a struggle with self-harm. When Misty lived on the reservation, she contracted H. pylori bacterium, which is frequently found in conjunction with a lack of clean water and proper sewage management, and it can cause stomach ulcers. The bacterium caused Misty to frequently throw up, and eventually stomach acids eroded her teeth to the point where she had to wear dentures. This is something that can really speak to the issue of living conditions on many reservations. This is still very much a problem, even today. According to the United States Census official website, as of 2016, 26.2% of Native Americans and Alaska Natives lived below the poverty line. Also according to the United States Census official website, 19.2% of Native Americans and Alaska Natives lacked health insurance in 2016. The Navajo Nation, which spans over 17 million acres across Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, is currently experiencing a water crisis that is resulting in higher rates of COVID-19 cases. About 30% of the population in Navajo Nation does not have running water. This poses a significant risk during a pandemic, when proper hand washing is absolutely essential. The Navajo Nation has one of the highest COVID infection rates per capita in the country. At 12 years old, Misty is said to have declared to her class, quote, "My name is Misty Upham, and someday you will know that name as the best living Native American actress," end quote. Misty got her start in acting with Red Eagle Soaring, a Native theater group based in Seattle, Washington. Red Eagle Soaring was started in 1991 with the goal of providing Native youth with an outlet for self-expression by way of integrating their cultural heritage and traditions into the performing arts. Since their founding, they have produced over 170 performances. By age 14, Misty was writing and directing her own skits. 4 years later, by age 18, she had been accepted into several different Seattle theater companies. Misty was described as being incredibly motivated in the pursuit of her acting career. She was strong-willed and strong-minded in this endeavor. She had been discouraged by former teachers from pursuing her love of acting, but despite this, she worked hard at it and persisted for over 5 years. At the age of 20, her perseverance paid off, and she landed her first feature film, Skins, which is a 2002 film directed by Chris Eyre, and tells the story of two brothers of the Sioux Nation and their life on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Misty portrayed a character named Mrs. Blue Cloud. The film is actually available to watch on Prime Video, and this is the film that truly launched her career. Misty continued to land movie roles, appearing in films such as Skinwalkers in 2002, Dreamkeeper in 2003, and Edge of America, also in 2003. One role that she may be more well-known for is her role in Frozen River in 2008 as Lila Littlewolf, starring alongside Melissa Leo. Misty was actually cast in the 2012 film Django Unchained, starring Jamie Foxx and Leo DiCaprio, as a character called Minnie, but her scenes were cut from the film for reasons unknown. In 2013, she acted in a film alongside Benicio del Toro called Jimmy P, Psychotherapy of a Plains Indian, in which del Toro's character is a war veteran of the Blackfeet Nation who suffers from debilitating neurological symptoms of PTSD. Cake is a 2014 film starring Jennifer Aniston, Sam Worthington, and Anna Kendrick, and tells the story of a woman who battles chronic pain. The main character takes a vested interest in the suicide of a woman from her chronic pain support group. In this film, Misty portrayed a character named Liz, but it was not released until after her death. I personally really enjoyed this movie, and it is available to watch on Prime Video. Perhaps Misty's biggest role was in the 2013 film August, Osage County, which tells the story of an Oklahoma family who was brought back together after a family crisis, and stars Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts. Misty stars as a character named Jana Monavada. Misty actually refused to take roles that would perpetuate harmful stereotypes about natives, such as alcoholism or being uneducated, the same things that Charles says he warned his family about when they moved away from the reservation.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In an interview on a podcast called The Opperman Report, hosted by private investigator Ed Opperman, Charles describes Misty as an incredibly passionate actress who poured herself into her roles. She really made the characters believable. Misty often brought her mother to set with her, and Charles believes that this was because she struggled so severely with anxiety and she felt safer with family being there with her. Misty's parents actually wanted to stay with their daughter while she pursued her acting career. However, this meant that Charles would have to leave his job, which did exacerbate the financial strain that her family had long faced. To help provide for her family, Misty often cleaned houses between auditions and filming. In 2014, Misty is quoted having said, "Acting has saved me from darkness many times." She wanted to create an opportunity for children to find the same comfort in acting that she had, and she had goals to establish a children's theater group. However, through all of her acting success, Misty still battled mental illness and substance abuse. Those close to her have said that she became addicted to benzodiazepines as a result of her struggles with anxiety. There is a severe mental health crisis among Indigenous people in America. This crisis has often been linked to the high rates of poverty among natives, as well as the limited access to affordable health care, including psychiatric care. I also certainly think that this crisis can be linked to America's history of horrific acts committed against Indigenous people, and the identity struggles that come with that, as well as the racism against Indigenous people that is still very much a glaring problem today. The National Center for Biotechnology Information conducted a study in 2014 that showed that approximately 21% of Native Americans and Alaska Natives over the age of 18 reported having had a mental illness within the past year. This was compared to 17.9% for the general population. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, in a TEDS report from 2014, suicide was the second leading cause of death for Native Americans and Alaska Natives between the ages of 10 and 34. Let me just really drive that point home. The second leading cause of death for Natives in this country between the ages of 10 years old, and 34. In May of 2014, Misty announced that she was pregnant and that she was going to name her baby Leaf. In Young's 2015 article with The Guardian, Charles says, quote, "She started keeping a journal for him, telling him who she was, how much she loved him, what she ate that day, anything and everything," end quote. According to family and friends, Misty had quit drinking as soon as she found out that she was pregnant. Tragically, less than a month after announcing her pregnancy, Misty publicly announced that she had miscarried, and her battle with her mental health grew worse. Eventually, Misty left California and returned to Washington because she wanted to be with her father. He'd had a stroke and was in recovery. Misty, along with her parents, moved into her sister's apartment in Auburn, Washington. She had trouble finding affordable health care, which is a problem all too common in this country. It was especially difficult for Misty to find consistent psychiatric care. She had previously been prescribed medications for depression, bipolar disorder, and PTSD, along with the medication she took for her anxiety. According to her father, it took 5 months for her to finally be scheduled for a psychiatric appointment. This appointment was scheduled for November 2014, but Misty would never make it to the appointment. On August 14, 2014, Charles Upham called the police in Auburn, Washington. Misty was angry and behaving erratically. Charles said that she was throwing things and even brandishing scissors in their apartment. An employee of the Muckleshoot Market and Deli across the street from the family's apartment also called the police. Misty had apparently moved from the apartment into the parking lot behind the deli. The employee reported that there was a, quote, "yelling, rambling woman prowling vehicles behind the business," end quote, according to police records. According to reports by the responding officers, Misty was allegedly hiding in the bushes and had lunged at an officer who was trying to talk to her. One officer stated that he and another officer grabbed Misty by the wrists and that she started kicking and flailing, all while yelling and screaming. The officer stated that they handcuffed her and put her into the patrol car. He then claims that once she was in the car, she started flailing and thrashing around again and that she was screaming. He says that she even spit out her dentures. Charles was watching the scene unfold from across the street, and he says that the officer's reports didn't get the story quite right. According to his interview in Young's article, he states, quote, "they were tapping the glass and making faces at her. She was crying and telling them to stop, that they couldn't treat her like this," end quote. He goes on to say that he thought it was better if the police didn't know that he and Misty's mother were watching. He feared that he would just get arrested. But he says that he did have to take Misty's purse over to the police because it had her medication in it. He says, quote, "so I go over there and he said to me, 'is she delusional? She thinks she's a movie star.' And I said, 'she is,'" end quote. That night, Misty was involuntarily committed as a result of the incident, and it was the third time that she had been involuntarily committed. In a Facebook post, Charles had said that he and her mother went to the ER to see her that night. They noticed that she had a swollen jaw, a black eye, and scratches on her shoulder. The ER staff stated that Misty had arrived in that condition. Misty herself couldn't recall how she had sustained the injuries, but she did say that it was why she was afraid of the police. The Auburn police denied later allegations of police brutality against Misty. However, one officer does admit later on that he did indeed mock Misty and her claims of being an actress. It is still not clear how or when Misty sustained the injuries observed on her body that night. On October 5th, 2014, Misty was again behaving erratically. Her father says that she was inconsolable that day. He dialed 911, but Misty took off. Charles started to go after her, but he was met by police before he could leave the apartment. He says the police insisted upon searching the apartment, even though he already told them that Misty was gone. He pleaded with them to go out and search for her. However, they wouldn't allow Charles to leave the apartment until they had spent about 10 minutes searching. He insisted that they needed to conduct a search for her, but the officers claimed that she had to be missing for 24 hours before they could officially search. I will say this every time this issue comes up. The 24-hour myth is just that, a myth. It is not true. This is portrayed heavily in fictitious crime shows and movies as a legitimate law, and for some reason is enforced by real-life law enforcement. There is no law that states that you must wait 24 hours to report someone missing, and police are under no requirement to wait 24 hours before they may conduct a search for someone. Charles called to officially report Misty as a missing person on October 6, 2014. Police consistently refused to elevate her missing status to endangered. A detective was assigned to Misty's case on October 7th. However, there was never an official search conducted by police. Charles says that police told him there wasn't enough evidence that she was actually missing, and that she was probably off partying somewhere. On October 10th, reporters requested a press release, but Commander Steve Stalker with the Auburn Police Department stated that he had no intentions of doing a press release about Misty's disappearance. On October 11th, Charles asked his cousin, Robert Upham, to form a search party. The police finally issued a press release detailing Misty's disappearance on October 13th, 8 days after she initially went missing. Family friends Robert Kennedy and Jeff Barehand joined the search for Misty on October 16th. Barehand was the board president of Red Eagle Soaring, where Misty had discovered her passion for acting and gotten her start over a decade earlier. The search team decided on a particular area of Auburn in which to focus their search efforts. And again, let me reiterate that there was never an official police search conducted for Misty. Never. It was her family and those close to her that did all of the searches, trying to find her. Kennedy was walking along a ridge in a secluded wooded area when he noticed a purple object on the ground. When he picked it up, he realized that it was a purse. He dumped the contents of the purse, and that's when he noticed a medicine bottle with the name Misty Upham printed on the label. Barehand continued on, and he stumbled upon a gray shoe. Moving further into the woods, he discovered a body. It was confirmed that the body they had discovered was Misty Upham. When questioned about police reluctance to prioritize Misty's case, Commander Mike Herman of the Auburn Police Department stated that Misty did not meet the department's criteria for elevating a missing person status to endangered. In the 2 years before her death, Auburn police had involuntarily committed Misty a total of 4 times. So tell me how she didn't meet the criteria for being an endangered missing person. They had been called during mental health crises that Misty had experienced. How is it that she didn't meet the criteria? The medical examiner later concluded that Misty likely died about 6 hours after her disappearance. A toxicology report showed that her blood alcohol content was 0.33 at the time of her death. Symptoms would include hindered or entirely absent reflexes, incontinence, possibly complete unconsciousness, and increased heart rate and irregular breathing. The medical examiner ruled Misty's cause of death as blunt force trauma to the head and torso. However, her manner of death, whether it be homicide, suicide, or an accident, could not be conclusively determined. Misty Upham was only 32 years old at the time of her death. The location where Misty was ultimately found was only 2 blocks from her family's apartment. Police had actually publicly taken credit for finding Misty, when in fact, it was close friends of the family who had found her. During an interview on a podcast called The Opperman Report, hosted by private investigator Ed Opperman, Charles goes into more detail about witness statements from the night that Misty disappeared. A woman who lived near the ravine where Misty was found had heard a woman screaming the night that Misty went missing. She called police and asked them to investigate, but they told her it was likely just a coyote. The medical examiner had determined that Misty likely died about 6 hours after she took off from her family's apartment, which would put her time of death sometime between 9 and 10 p.m. that night, according to Charles. Charles had also informed the police that another witness had seen Misty at a nearby casino soon before her estimated time of death, but police never followed up on this lead. According to Charles, another witness had said that there was a house party nearby where Misty had been drinking that night. The witness claimed that Misty had gotten into a verbal altercation with two men who beat her and threw her over the ridge and into the ravine. Police claimed that they looked into this statement and that it was all made up. Yet another witness claimed that local police themselves were involved in Misty's death and that Misty had fallen into the ravine because she was running from police in the dark. Again, these are just witness statements and they have not been confirmed as fact. Everything about the way that police handled Misty's disappearance is absolutely heinous. First of all, why did they waste 10 minutes searching the apartment and not allowing Charles to go search for his daughter when he already told them that she had taken off? They literally refused to search for her after being well aware of her history with mental health struggles. They also refused to elevate her status to endangered. Charles had even tried to contact the mayor when he was pushing to have Misty listed as an endangered missing person, but he never got a response to these efforts. During the same interview on the Opperman Report podcast, Charles says that upon receiving her death certificate and a copy of the ME report that he had requested, he noticed that the documents had differing information. The case numbers on both documents were different, and the ME report listed Misty as a Caucasian female. Charles requested to have this issue looked into, but has never received a response. Her family never even got to see her body. They were only permitted to pray over her after she was brought up from the ravine in a body bag. Misty was later cremated. The irresponsibility in the investigation into Misty's death even spread to the media, as the media incorrectly reported her death as a suicide on more than one occasion. Again, the medical examiner could not conclusively determine whether Misty was the victim of homicide, suicide, or an accident. This pattern of dismissal and disrespect from the police was not unfamiliar to Misty's family. After she had been gang raped at 13 years old, her parents tried to go to the tribal police, but they didn't take it seriously and they brushed off the report. Nothing was ever done to punish the boys who had assaulted and abused Misty. In early October 2017, it was reported by both the New York Times and the New Yorker that there were dozens of allegations of sexual assault and rape against film producer and founder of the Weinstein Company, Harvey Weinstein. These allegations spanned a period of over 30 years, and Weinstein, of course, denied every single allegation. Harvey Weinstein was arrested in May 2018 and charged with rape and numerous other offenses. In February 2020, he was found guilty of rape in the third degree, and ultimately, in March 2020, was sentenced to 23 years in prison. The allegations against Harvey Weinstein launched a very well-known social media campaign known as the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement ignited the courage to come forward in scores of women, both celebrities and everyday people, in light of the allegations against Weinstein. But the movement seemed to have left someone out. On October 15, 2017, Misty's father, Charles Upham, went public with allegations that Misty had been raped at the 2013 Golden Globe Awards. Misty had been invited to the 2013 Golden Globe Awards because Django Unchained had been nominated for 5 awards, and much of the cast and production team would be in attendance, including Misty's good friend, Quentin Tarantino, who directed the film. According to Misty, she was forced into the men's restroom, where an executive of the Weinstein Company raped her. Other patrons of the award ceremony who were also in the restroom allegedly cheered on her rapist as she walked away, even giving him high fives. None of them lifted a finger to help her. About a week later, Misty opened up to her mother about the incident. However, it's still unclear whether it happened at the Golden Globes venue or at an after party. Misty never named her rapist, even to her parents, but she did say that she knew exactly who he was. And again, she said he was an executive of the Weinstein Company. She said that her rapist was an extremely influential man with a lot of connections, and that she was incredibly fearful of him. Misty's parents tried to encourage her to report it to the police, but she was adamant that she didn't want to, and that she was too afraid to take action against the Weinstein Company. She felt that no one would believe her, and that the company would try to discredit her and ruin her career. In that same podcast interview, on the Opperman Report, Charles shares an excerpt from one of Misty's writings, where she had written about the after effects of sexual assault and rape. Her father shares, quote, "People say that rape and sexual assault do not leave many physical scars. So untrue. Your mental health is physical. Is not your mind another part of your body? There are scars, but they're all on the inside. Fear and anxiety, panic attacks, I can't seem to be free of them. My father is well coached in panic attacks. He used to get them also. He will sit with me through this whole ordeal, telling me to remember that everything is going to be all right, because he knows that I'm stuck in a hurricane that he can't see." End quote. And again, that was an excerpt from Misty's own personal writings. Her father had shared plans to put some of her writings together into a book, to give an inside look into Misty's mind. Misty Upham was a beautiful, incredibly gentle woman who was so full of ambition and light, and she just struggled with demons that so many of us also face. She suffered so much abuse and trauma at the hands of other people, and she deserved better. She deserved justice for the things that she endured, for the things that other people did to her. Even after her death, police didn't treat her with any of the respect or compassion that she was owed. Charles Upham is a brilliant, compassionate man who, to this day, still tries to keep his daughter's story alive. Hearing him talk about her is both heartwarming and absolutely heart-wrenching. He was so proud of his daughter, and he would do absolutely anything for her. His entire family deserved better from the police. As of 2017, Charles had plans to release a documentary film called 11 Days, The Search for Misty Upham, detailing Misty's disappearance and the aftermath of finding her. I believe there is a trailer up for this documentary on YouTube. However, as of December of last year, there was not enough money for them to complete the production of the documentary, and I'm not sure whether they still have plans to produce it. I hope that this episode has opened up a discussion about things that desperately need to be talked about. This was The Life and Death of Misty Upham. Thank you for listening. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Crime Again Pod, and you can also like the Facebook page, Crime and Crime Again Podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.